In the night that followed, a few hours after Shannon called me with the news that Beholden had been selected for the Grawemeyer Award, I had a dream. In this dream, I was in a crowd of people who were moving, as if at some academic gathering, through a series of long white corridors. Tall windows along the corridors looked out onto verdant green quads. Our destination seemed to be through an open doorway far up ahead, where a field of grasses whipped in the wind. In that field, a small aircraft was poised, propellers running, that would take us up, I knew not where. For most of the first half of the dream, my biggest worry was to keep hold of something in my hands, a peanut butter sandwich. The sandwich was not a gift, it was not charity. I'd made it myself at the beginning of the dream. And this is a true story. But it was a vital security, and I was desperately afraid that I would drop or lose it. No one else carried any food, and I seemed to be the only person worrying over something as trivial as my next meal. Halfway through the dream, we passed through a majestic hall of carved dark wood where a religious service had just ended. Jostled by the crowds back out into the corridor, I discovered that I was holding, not my sandwich, but a prayer book. A name identified the book as belonging to one of the clergy in the crowd. He was someone very well known to me, and I felt urgently that he must want it back. So I spent the rest of the dream in an effort to press through the dense crowds to reach him to return his prayer book. But at best, I had only glimpses of him, far ahead, contentedly in conversation. He seemed to have no worries at all about anything he might have left behind. As the dream ended, we were all, at last, approaching the open doorway into the field where the plane was waiting, and around it those verdant bright grasses streaming in the wind. Now, I suspect there are a few Jungians in the audience who may be all too ready to offer me an analysis of this dream. I tell it, however, because it seems to suggest, or at least suggest to me, some of the broader concerns of religion, health, and social justice explored in Beholden, which I would like to reflect on here tonight. My talk will be shaped, at least in spirit, by the dream's initial focus on that peanut butter sandwich, something so mundane that we may think of it as a poor person's meal, or maybe essential whey bread for survival, and its transformation into a tool for communal prayer and worship as a metaphor for our own lives, hopes, and vision for global health. We are all here tonight because we share in some measure a value and concern for the intersection between the incarnate body and practical faith-based identity informed by a vision for hope and justice. And the majesty of being here with you this week is not unlike the sense of beauty, good action, and potential for hope that marked the spirit of my dream. My imagination before Shannon's phone call had never included anything so grand or unlikely as this astonishing award and this welcoming time this week with your faculty and students. I expect I will spend the rest of my life exploring creative opportunities to live out my appreciation for this tremendous honor and responsibility. We live, says the historian Ted Campbell, not only by our understanding of reality, but also by our dreams of what reality may become. For me, and perhaps also for you, a vision of how things ought to be as it relates to the incarnate body includes a concern for health equity and a sense of obligation and accountability towards the embodied health of others in this world. Article 25 of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights lists the essential ingredients of such health as founded on entitlements to, quote, food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond one's control, unquote. The images raised by this list have much in common with Jesus' list of righteous acts in Matthew 25, the parable of the sheep and goats, where he praises responses to the needs of those who are hungry, thirsty, in prison, unclothed, sick, and so forth. Such basic human rights, or righteous acts, depending on your perspective, touch on what we today call the social determinants of health. Our efforts to take such actions seriously underlie public health concerns as well as religious humanitarian aid activities around the world today. Our values for religion and for health justice that cares about the physical body, taken together, shape how we understand material goods, our moral accountability to truth and to one another, and our journey into deeper wisdom in light of more liminal realities and our ever-imminent mortality. So we value religion and the body, yet there's also a tension here. In the public health and human rights field, talk about religion can seem out of place. A suspicion about religion is also common among academics. Public health activists, for instance, might accuse religious volunteers of propaganda, ignorance, or naivety. Religious conservatives in medical missions, on the other hand, may decry the evidence-based interventions and programs of their secular counterparts as post-Enlightenment liberalism. The consequences of these tensions can pit humanitarianism against human rights, or pit charity against solidarity and social justice. I first encountered this tension as a graduate student years ago in nutrition. I was chatting one day with my professor about my interests, and I told her I was especially curious about how religious beliefs shape the food choices that directly influence health, especially in settings of poverty. But as soon as I said the word religious, I felt her freeze. This glacial wall of disapproval and distance rose up between us. To me, it was an academic topic, but my professor obviously thought, oh my God, a religious fanatic, a Western imperialist who's going into nutrition so she can do evangelism. Horror of horrors. I later learned that such had been her family background, and it had turned her against certain formal views of religion. But after our chat that day, I wondered if this silent taboo was going to mean the end of my own hopes for a career related to global concerns of food, hunger, and religion. It did not, happily, though it did lead me on a much more roundabout vocational journey. The divide between these two approaches to global aid also profoundly shaped the way I started to think about historical research. Now, some of these tensions have eased a little since the HIV/AIDS epidemic and 9/11. Today, there is more openness to talk about and even sometimes fund faith-health collaborations. But fractures remain, often rooted in historical patterns, implicit biases about race, class, and ethnicity. Now, obviously, we don't need to parse out our every motive, bias, and value in order to save someone's life. Assuming you have the skills necessary, you just jump in. But whether we act or whether we do research, write, or ponder, we all share the challenge of finding ways to talk together, to connect common values and goals in ways that actually support the life and health of our community existence on this planet. Whether we're an artist, a teacher, an engineer, a pastor, or a gardener, we may wonder how we can act wisely to nurture and support collaborative synergies. How do we hold our own in our piece of the conversations in a world where people and groups have radically different views from us about faith, rights, and the embodiment of physical and social wellness? These were the questions that shaped much of my thinking as I wrestled with the writing of the book Beholden. As those of you who have read it will know, I found it most useful to explore such questions by teasing out voices that represented a range of ideological planes where public or global health and faith issues may find themselves, for better or for worse, together on the same playing field. In the book, I look at five of these approaches. One, pilgrimage, or the search for the sacred. The second is civic duty, or how we see our obligations as national and global citizens. The third is human rights, particularly health, in the context of economic, social, and cultural, or ESC, rights. The fourth is religious health assets, as they might strengthen health systems. And fifth, the base metal that most often coins this dialogue, practices of gift charity, often minted with terms like compassion or love. For each of these five lenses, I use stories to try and unknot some level of understanding how they work and the potential for connections and a broader integrative vision. In his theological memoir a few years ago, Stanley Hauerwas said, "Writing is the only way I know how to think." And this is also true for me. Beholden took up these issues not because I thought I could solve them, but because I needed a place where I could worry out in a constructive way how they usually take shape and how they might relate to our hope, despair, aspirations, and faith in imagining a better world. For me, vocational meaning takes life through the beauty of creative narrative, especially narrative connected with research. So Beholden is basically about the idea that if we want to make a difference in the world, we need to draw on creativity and imagination in our vision and dreams for what may be possible, yes, in health and yes, in religion. The book dares to suggest that imagination and hope have a place in a life of faith and can be real and important global health tools for building positive change. Ultimately, the book suggests that the essence of effective response in the making of community for health and justice depends more on being than on doing. In our efforts to nurture equity and essential health rights as persons of faith, that is, it's not the stuff we own, worry about, sort, exchange, and trash that's going to change the world. Rather, it's the value of our time. It's not charity, but justice with respect and dignity in all that is both good and intangible in our relationships with one another and with ourselves. Now, to focus on being does not mean we do nothing. For those of you who teach, certainly there's a keen need and I think an interest in developing broader approaches to cross-disciplinary mentoring. Brainstorming about new ideas for existing programs, coursework, research, or fieldwork, and ministry. It may begin as simply as getting students from different disciplines in the same room together so they can begin to think and talk beyond the common polarities of either evangelistic preaching to convert on the one hand or bad-mouthing religion in a generic way for its lamentable and often destructive biases on the other. I invite readers to integrate many different stories and voices into a more nuanced wrestling with these and other modern tensions, global challenges, risks, and opportunities. Rainer Maria Rilke, in 1903, called this living the questions. Sometimes the best we can do, as we consider the human condition, Rilke told a young poet, is to welcome the uncomfortable truth that we don't have all the answers. Living out the questions is to open our mind and heart to the unresolved unknown in the world and in our deepest self. It is to pay attention to what bothers us, to the mess and gray areas in global action that affect how we treat the person next door, down the street, or in the next room. As we live with discomfort and listen across religions and cultures, we face what in the book I call our beholdenness, our inevitable interdependent vulnerabilities, our sometimes uncomfortable obligation to one another as moral sentient beings who really care about religion and the body, though perhaps not always in that order. Living the questions may nudge us to think differently about our own suffering, and by it, connect more intentionally and authentically with the suffering of others. Let me be clear here. To live the questions does not mean we quiver in theological doubt. It does not call us to compromise deeply life-giving beliefs or convictions. Nor does it give us a convenient excuse to just listen, to avoid necessary and right action. For many of us, especially those of us here tonight, faith is a subterranean cable that holds together the very center of our being. It's one that binds us to a life and meaning profoundly close to the bone. To live the questions is by nature to value all of that life, including our own and those around us. The poet Robert Lacks had something to say about this. One of Thomas Merton's oldest friends, Lacks spent his life practicing a daunting material simplicity. He was a sort of free-spirited, sociable monk who lived in the world, mostly in Greece, and at the end of his life on the island of Patmos. His vocation was clearly that of a poet. Yet Lacks did not hesitate in a 1953 letter to Merton to beg his friend, quote, "Pray me out of weariness. I want to be agile for good," unquote. I find this so cheering. Often we too are deeply weary. More burdened than Lacks by material ties, we may, like him, long to be agile for good. In living the questions within the sacred gift of our own spaces and callings, perhaps we might find new ways to live out this agility in the kind of hope that, as the Apostle Paul puts it, does not disappoint. To be agile for good as it relates to health justice is first of all to affirm the religious value of social justice as well as, dare I add, human rights. Despite a realm of sometimes volcanic philosophic nuances, the idea of rights does percolate in various ways through the work of many religious writers across the centuries who have persistently championed justice for the poor. In early Christianity, where I focus much of my research, the idea we think of today as rights was something that, for at least a few patristic authors, went hand in hand with a religious ethic of material equity. I offer a number of examples in the book to remind us that both equity and human rights, understood broadly, are not a newfangled post-Enlightenment fixation. For example, the 4th century bishop Asterius of Amasya, writing from the mountains near the Black Sea in northern Turkey, argued against those who would say that economic inequalities meant one person was better than another. Preaching on Lazarus and the rich man, Asterius was outraged that we who are created equal live on such unequal terms with those of the same race. He condemns covetousness precisely because it creates anomalia, literally an anomaly, something that's wrong, because it is, as he put it, a marked disparity in the conditions of life between human persons created equal in worth. Asterius's contemporary, Gregory of Nazianzus, called the theologian, appeals explicitly to a primary equity, equality of rights. And Lactantius, writing in Latin a generation earlier, around the year 300, said, quote, "We are all God's children with equal rights. Therefore, grab hold of true justice in its true form. Give to the blind, the sick, the lame, and the destitute. Cherish them as much as you can, and sustain their souls with humanity," unquote. Beholden started out as an idea for a basic primer on human rights, one that I hoped my friends in ministry might actually find relevant, and as a reminder to the people in public health that history matters. But if you want to put a rights-based framework into practice, or even if you simply hope to work in constructive conversation with rights activists or rights-based health workers while holding a different view, it's not simply enough to know the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or its related international laws and covenants. Yes, we should know those things, of course, but it's also vital for us to have at least some idea of what it actually would mean to translate this into daily practice and attitude. Health rights are just tools, but they are tools that, used well, can change relationships of power. Thus, a rights-based approach is not something you can simply copy off the internet, print as a fact sheet, post on the wall next to your OSHA regulations, or simply open a box or book, pour and mix. A true rights-based approach may call us to think in very new ways about how we see the world and others around us. It may call us to practice principles like those that human rights lawyers today identify as, for example, three particular ideas: accountability, participation, and non-discrimination and equality. Each of these three is a huge critical concept in itself, but let me at least summarize them each in a quick sentence. A health program that respects accountability, for example, would practice an interdependent transparency. It would hold accountable everyone in the system, from funders on down, for basic things like respect, dignity, finances, utilities that actually work, and specific policies and practices in situations of shortage and gap. Second, a program that respects the principle of participation would be designed and practiced so that everyone involved has an equitable and meaningful voice at the table, including how things actually run. Those most affected by a health risk, that is, would be actively enabled to lead and drive the solutions. And third, a program that also respects the principle of non-discrimination and equality would be measurable by how it delivers care. Are goods and services really available, accessible, acceptable, and of adequate quality for everyone equitably without unfair exclusion or bias? Now, once again, this is a very broad brush stroke of huge ideas that I'm not going to go into any further here. My point here is that with such concrete principles, you can ask concrete questions. You can measure and evaluate if rights are really taking shape in action or not. Social justice that lives within a rights-based framework for health is not like giving out Christmas presents. Practiced within a faith-based context, it might be more about deliberate integration with the equity of God's goodness. It's also important to remember that living such principles is difficult at the best of times. This difficulty is compounded if we ourselves seem to be the ones who lack power for change. Like my dream, we may find ourselves chronically challenged when we are the little ordinary people, shaped by basic efforts of holding on to our peanut butter sandwich lives, struggling to hold things together. Sustaining action for health equity is a constant challenge. A personal commitment to integrity does not ensure us success or long-term solidarity. But it may open us up to small flashes of light that have the hope and potential to save a life here and there, perhaps even our own. In most cases, real health justice requires political buy-in. Even with such limitations, we must still, I think, beg one another, pray me out of weariness. I want to be agile for good. Beyond the legal process, health justice can also endure on a softer level through relational and religious ethics. Ultimately, to apply a meaningful, empowering rights-based approach, says one health and human rights lawyer, calls on us to create difference in the world, to make a different world, and to make ourselves different in the process. But, you may ask, are Christmas presents really so bad? And this brings us to the other phrase in my title for this talk, hermeneutic of blessing. What has justice to do with blessing? If, as religious people, we can embrace theological foundations for justice and rights, can those of us with a passion for the secular world of public health and global health make room for religious language of blessing, perhaps while also affirming ideals of equity in settings of economic poverty? Blessing is one of those religious words, suggesting a supernatural metaphysic. In religious charity, we sometimes hear people speak of blessings when what they really mean are religious gifts or handouts, one-way distributions commonly linked with assumptions about material wealth, economic security, and systems that those who work in health equity more often condemn as unhealthy biases and disparities. One example, of course, is the American prosperity gospel. And this view, as Duke scholar Kate Bowler describes it, the very basic idea of blessing as material gifts frequently morphs into the idea of reward. When those who, like Job's tormenting friends, assume that God's blessing means health and wealth, then big ideas, like God's goodness, get reduced to economic trivia. But over and over again, those who lack power and agency in life, the poor around the world, tell us that what they really want is not so much wealth and security, but rather, first and also, dignity, respect, and justice. These are values that those who talk about blessings often fail to deliver. The Gospel of Luke is the only place where Jesus' Beatitudes explicitly cry, "Woe to the rich." But certainly the tune of both Matthew and Luke's beatific images of religious blessing hum toward a mystery that is more about a fulfillment that goes far beyond our small vision of material prosperity and biocellular harmony. So then, what do I mean by hermeneutic of blessing? And can such a concept be compatible again with health justice? Hermeneutic is a theoretical word that I know clings to the fibers of seminary chapels and pulpits. It's a word that simply points to the way we interpret something. And to offer an experimental interpretation of blessing that might encourage health, I turn now to briefly look at a religious practice that I talk about in the last few pages of the book. This is a practice Christians in late antiquity were involved in that involved the exchange and sharing of small material tokens called eulogia. And here I'm indebted to the historian Daniel Kaner for this idea as it relates to both religious ritual and faith-based aid. The word eulogia means quite literally blessing. But this word, as used in late antique Christian texts about need as well as gifts, was not promoting a prosperity gospel. Indeed, to think about eulogial exchanges, it might be helpful here to have in our minds first another idea of religious gifting that may be more familiar and common to us who have spent much of our lives in Protestant circles. And that idea goes something like this. We believe that God is generous. And so we use the word blessing to speak of God's goodness to us as it relates to God's generosity and free grace. And out of our gratitude and our recognition that such grace and salvation is a gift, we commit ourselves to turn to honor the image and nature of God's character by sharing with others in need whatever we think of as God's blessings, whether material or immaterial. That's a quick summary of the Lutheran view I grew up on. But the connections between free grace, gratitude, and blessing is by no means a uniquely Protestant idea. Patristic sermons on poverty relief also ring with appeals to imitate the goodness of God, the original designer of good deeds, as Gregory of Nyssa put it. And Gregory's brother, Basil of Caesarea, wrote in his second sermon on giving thanks, a sermon on the martyr Julita, quote, "The assets that are given to you, advance them to the benefactor by your alms through the hands of the poor. And although God has in this way received God's own property, so it is a perfect thanks, as you have given from your own goods," unquote. Thus, Basil says, the perceptive person can return thanks throughout all conditions of life in proportion to present graces. Thus, practicing a sharing of blessings out of thankfulness is not something the Christian should envision or treat as a token handout. It is rather an act of perfect thanks, indeed a practice of becoming. Now, such a hermeneutic or interpretive lens that sees things in terms of blessing rooted in God's intentional generosity and goodness to all of creation is also, of course, not exclusive to Christianity. It exists in appeals to faith-based aid from across religious traditions. It's not a simplistic idea either. It is usually tightly bound together with a range of sometimes very different and complex nuances. References to God's generosity in early Christian texts often sit smack dab in the middle of appeals for redemptive almsgiving, for total divestment, and even nasty biases about the worthy and unworthy beggar. The same authors also speak both of God's common generosity and the obvious reality that some people really get a bum rap in life. As with the modern concept, early Christian ethics of aid is a knotted weave of strings whose patterns don't always seem clear or logical. And different writers reflect different voices. Material goods are always part of the mix, but the call to mutual participation in faith-based blessings is almost never about wealth. It is instead about an openness of exchange steeped in divine virtue, compassion, and yes, I'll say it again, social justice. The exchange of eulogia became a regular practice by the 5th to the 7th centuries, involving small material gifts. They had meaning as part of liturgical and social rituals that were rooted in church, monastic, and lay relationships, and indeed the practice persists today in some circles. In patristic Greek texts, eulogia might refer to praise or a mark of favor. It might also be a coin or a bribe. It's not a perfect word. It might be a liturgical benediction or monastic dispensation. Or it might, our meaning here, refer to a small edible gift, such as a piece of bread or fruit. Eulogiae were meant to be pure disinterested gifts, tokens of divine rather than human power. They came into being at the altar, where food donations were blessed, and they took life as very small portions that clergy gave to one another and to the laity, transmitting a spirit of blessing reified. They could also be used as medicine. Sick pilgrims visiting healing shrines might be given a cheap lead or clay flask that was filled with oil and dirt, skimmed off some holy person, relic, or ground. And actually, some of the surviving flasks are stamped literally with the word eulogia. They were never viewed as expressions of justice, as far as I can tell, but those who wrote about them were also often people who cared much about aid ethics, including ethics of justice. Eulogia were not charity or alms, though you could use them that way if you chose to. The 5th century desert monk John of Gaza said that both beggars and non-Christians could receive eulogia, since in his view, the eulogia has the power of God to both bless and lead its recipients to an understanding of truth. As mouth-sized gifts, eulogia were not intended to satisfy hunger, nor did they challenge a corrupt system. They were blessings that began at the altar and imply a liturgical hierarchy. But their exchange dynamics could be very circular and even sometimes ridiculous. In one modern story from Egypt, for example, someone gave this magnificent bunch of grapes to a monastic abbot. The bunch was accorded appropriately blessed, and then it was passed from monk to monk to monk to monk within the monastery. And each monk so valued the cluster and its divine meaning that he kept the cycle going a bit long in this naturally drying climate. So by the time the grapes reached the visitor who wrote about them, this symbol or edible token of blessing had withered down into a small bowl of raisins. It's that visitor who leaves us the story. He also ate the raisins. Thus, eulogiae function as a sort of spiritual spare change, an edible coinage in an economy of divine goodness. Now, can such an idea be useful in faith-based ethics related to health, poverty, and justice today? Some may argue that it cannot. After all, church groups are often condemned because, as one Haitian human rights lawyer put it in criticizing religious philanthropy, they come with just a little, but they come with cameras. And millions across the world need food and medicine that is far more than just a token, enough to nourish and heal day after day. Indeed, the most toxic, drug-resistant tuberculosis we face in today's world developed perhaps because people were not able to take the right dose of the right drugs they needed at the right time. Healing, like good nutrition, is not helped by token doses. Such tokens, with or without cameras, more often seem to dehumanize, especially when we give them as leftovers that best belong in our compost bin rather than our religious altar. Eulogia, on the other hand, are by nature fragments of treasure. They are by definition part of a direct personal exchange, one shared in a mutual spirit of respect, dignity, humanity, and grace. Yes, eulogiae are bits of this and that, but they embody spiritual meaning only when and if they bear and enhance collective and community solidarity and goodness. For the essence of blessing, what makes them eulogiae, is the relational dynamic, the nature of an interaction shaped in sacred mindfulness. We who dwell in and identify with the global faith community may find it helpful to envision eulogiae today not in terms of bits of bread or spare coins or spare portions, but in terms of life itself. In the last chapter of Beholden, I point to this image toward an embodied alterity of blessing in the end, the idea of becoming eulogia people. Perhaps we cannot change the world, but we can live in a recognition of corporate and communal eulogiae in how we regard and treat one another, rooted in a sense of transcendent reality, of living the questions of our own beholdenness to a global responsibility for good. Mindfulness of the small trusts we hold may help nurture our shared ideals of justice, health, and equity. Once again, we're back to being rather than doing. In conclusion, yes, tensions persist in connecting religion and global health today. There is a felt need for persons of faith and non-sectarian health workers to nurture and build creative and constructive collaborative spaces that can help advance the common hopes and goals they share. Re-envisioning a hermeneutic or interpretive lens of blessing may not in itself resolve the chronic distrust of such tensions, nor the world's problems. To live our lives as eulogia people doesn't free us from moral obligation to faith-based social justice and righteousness. Yet across the centuries, blessing and justice have always danced together in the vast otherness of God and our neighbor. Let us at least strive to maintain a humble openness, to listen seriously to sufferings as far as we are able within our theological frameworks for hope. Finally, to return to the images of my dream, let us take up our small and ordinary lives and allow their transformation, perhaps, into sacred narrative that can impel us forward in the restoration of a healing world. Thank you.